The views expressed on the Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate radio stations airing the show.
You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw. I'm William Goodenough.
And I'm Bruce Goodness.
The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWA LP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS LP in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806.
The show is brought to you by Firestone Books and Coffee, located at 610 Haywood Road. Firestone Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville, specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. Firestorm's full catalog of books and zines can be found online at firestorm.coop.
In 2012, a power vacuum formed in parts of northern Syria as a result of the civil war. These areas, part of the lands inhabited by Kurdish peoples, soon became a testing ground for an implementation of an anti-state communalism influenced in part by an American former anarchist turned communist named Murray Bookchin. Bookchin's thought helped to shape the ideas of Abdullah Öcalan, ideological leader of the Kurdish Workers' Party, PKK, in neighboring Turkey. The people participating in what's been branded the Rojava Revolution are organizing administration and defense based from the neighborhood councils and popular militias, are attempting to fight external enemies like the Syrian military of Bashar al-Assad and ISIL/Daesh, as well as the internal structures which hold in most societies such as patriarchy, class division, and xenophobia. Anarchists, anti-capitalists of all stripes from around the world, feminists, ecologists, these people and more around the world are among those engaging with the three-year-running experiment of Rojava. This week's episode features the first of three segments of conversation with Paul Z. Simons, a post-left anarchist and co-editor of Modern Slavery magazine. Paul, writing under the name El Errante, documented his recent trip to the Rojava region in northern Syria. This first episode will not be followed up immediately by another episode on the subject. However, we are making the second and third episodes content available alongside of this one online. If you're in a hurry to hear the complete conversation on his observations of institutions and organizing on the ground in Rojava, visit radioforall.net, search for The Final Straw and Rojava, and you'll find all three conversations as separate files podcasting from that site. Bruce and Paul talk about democratic confederalism, gender ecology, international intervention, religion, ethnicity, anti-capitalism, competing tendencies, holding tensions, international fighters, and much, much more.
Next week on The Final Straw, you'll hear a conversation with an anarchist in Spain about recent and continued repression of anarchists in that country. Updates on the situation can be found at efectopandora.wordpress.com. That's efectopandora.wordpress.com. And there's an English tab. And for past episodes of The Final Straw that have chatted on this subject, you can go to thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org and search for the phrase Pandora.
But first, this brief announcement. At Grand Valley Institute for Women, GVI, a federal prison in Kitchener, Ontario, there has been a recent crackdown against LGBTQ and Two-Spirit prisoners and or prisoners in relationships amongst themselves. Intimate relationships between prisoners are being attacked by a clique of guards acting without apparent direction or oversight from the Corrections Canada administration. We need your support with a call-in campaign to end these practices. Harassment of prisoners includes throwing them in solitary as punishment for being in a relationship, threatening them with transfers to remote parts of the country, separating partners by placing them in different parts of the prison, and laying spurious institutional charges that can lead to being locked in the maximum security unit. Most troublingly, guards have been using physical intimidation and invasions of personal space to harass prisoners who speak up against these practices. The prisoners have been organizing in response to these attacks, but have faced increasing repression for their efforts. Outside support right now can make a major difference in putting a check on the repression of prisoner relationships and dissent among prisoners. To protest this treatment, it's asked that people call Grand Valley Institute for Women at area code 519-894-2011. For more guidance on how to conduct this phone call and for updates on the situation, you can visit the website gviwatch.wordpress.com.
I'm speaking with El Errante, a.k.a. Paul Z. Simons, who recently chronicled experiences of a visit to Rojava, the PYD-administered, I guess I should correct that, in Tevdem-administered regions of northern Syria.
That's a lot closer. Yeah, I would go with Tevdem or locally administered. We'll try to get it to the bottom of that.
Yeah, please. Paul was on the show last year speaking with William about his work as an editor of Modern Slavery magazine. Thanks a lot for coming on, Paul.
I really appreciate it. I like being here.
For any listeners who aren't aware, can you just explain all the background in one or two sentences about Rojava and what's going on there? Just kidding.
I can go into it a little bit. So basically, I mean, it begins in the Arab Spring, and you know, the Arab Spring was basically populations primarily Arabic, but other populations as well, rising up across the Middle East, you know, throwing out dictators and trying to bring in somewhat more democratic, representative elected governments. In Syria, the Assad regime, as opposed to kind of knuckling under and allowing the people to at least have, you know, the appearance of some type of say, fought back. And it caused a lot of army officers to defect to form the Free Syrian Army. A lot of the jihadis and Islamists then formed their own parties and their own militias. And in the north of the country, where Assad had been dealing with the restive Kurdish population, the Kurds, who had been, you know, being fed military equipment as well as, you know, cadre, things like that, through Turkey, effectively opened up what we now know to be Rojava, or the Kurdish Autonomous Region, which started out very small, kind of around Qamishli, and then kind of pushed their way militarily, and now span effectively the northern tier with a little bite at the very northwest that is not controlled by the Kurdish Autonomous Region. But it's roughly, I would say, 100 kilometers to maybe 150 kilometers of a slice from northern, you know, from the Turkish border south, and includes three separate provinces or cantons. Kobani, whose capital is Kobani, and Jazira, whose capital is Qamishli, and Afrin, whose capital is Afrin. Afrin's a different story. There are battles and there are battle lines that kind of every once in a while will block access to the city of Afrin. So I never made it there. So that, you know, at that point in time, kind of the jihadi du jour was the al-Nusra Front, and the Kurds had fought a number of incursions with them. There was an attempt in November of 2012 to seize Serikanye, which is a town between Kobane and Qamishli, kind of a medium-sized town, maybe about 100,000 people. The Kurds, through the PYD, which is kind of the party that carries some of the ideas of the Kurdish Workers' Party, the PKK from Turkey, had, for all intents and purposes, rather rapidly put together an effective militia called the YPG. They had been on the ground in Syria for a while, but with the with the fall of the Assad regime, or the effective, you know, displacement of the Assad regime, these guys, they became very rapidly a very effective militia force. And I haven't touched on it yet, but one of the reasons for that is that these commanders and some of the middle level logistics folks came from Turkey. And they had been fighting, for all intents and purposes, an insurrectionary war against the Turkish state since 1984. So these were not guys who fell out of a Christmas tree and picked up a Kalashnikov and started killing, Daesh fighters or al-Nusra fighters. They're guys who knew the game, knew the score, and were very effective military commanders. They also carried with them, you know, 20 years of training and understanding of revolutionary politics. And since 2005, for, you know, a little less than 10 years, this concept of democratic confederalism, which they brought with them in much the same way as they brought their military tactics as well. So I think that a lot of the military authorities around the world are just like, how the hell did the Kurds come up with such an effective fighting force in the space of, you know, for all intents and purposes, 6 months? And the reality is that these are guys who've been training and fighting for years. They just found themselves in Rojava as opposed to in the mountains around, in southern Turkey. So
that seems to be a difficulty that the West has with, or at least media wise and governments just sort of reacting to a circumstance. Where did ISIS or Daesh come from? It's just suddenly popped out of nowhere and suddenly it's got thousands of fighters on the ground with different skills, instead of realizing that destabilizing the region led to all these defectors from the Iraqi military.
Yeah, and it's the Daesh thing, and I don't want to deal with it too much. It's kind of an interesting, it's one of the games that the foreign journalists play at night when they don't have anything else going on, is where did Daesh come from? And kind of the general consensus is that most of it, I mean, because these guys were well healed by the time they made it to Syria, so they had a lot of weapons, and they were primarily American weapons. So the understanding is that for whatever reason, many people think that Saddam Hussein's tribe, his tribal country people, had seized a number of weapons, had seized a great deal of ammunition and weapons, and that the military base of Daesh is actually kind of Saddam Hussein's family members and friends striking back at the West.
That's interesting. I'd never heard that before.
Yeah, well, and this is, some of the journalists are pretty hooked into the intelligence structures. Some of them were like me, which is, lucky to be alive. So, I don't know how much credence there is, but it certainly makes a lot of sense. When you think about it, because there's no way that they could get their hands on the Syrian military stuff that they did until they started taking cities, and they pushed west initially from Iraq and not east from Syria. So there's a certain level of sense to it. It kind of goes how to show that, you throw a pebble in a pond and you get ripples that are going to affect that pond for, days. And so this may be the effect of Iraqi war, the first Iraqi war, the second Iraqi war, certainly. So very interesting.
So for folks that don't understand, and this is something I've read a little bit about and I don't really know, and so maybe you can clarify. but so we've been talking about in northern Syria, the Kurdish population, and the Kurdish population is spread throughout a few or finds itself living within a few different states within that region in
right.
What's called generally Kurdistan by Kurdish nationalists and also by like some historians.
Sure.
Can you talk about like, They're unified by language, but not necessarily by religious values, right? Or necessarily like political affiliation.
Well, political affiliation. They're spread across southern Turkey, which is kind of the homeland, the mountains. It's probably the original area that the Kurds had populated. Northern Syria, the Rojava region, which was under the Syrian state until 2012. Northern Iraq, starting from about Arbil north, and this is the population, during Gulf War I, when the Bush 1 administration had asked the population to rise up against Saddam, the Kurds and their army, the Peshmerga, followed suit, and they were abandoned by the U.S. and chopped up piecemeal and gassed by Hussein's regime. The same promise was made by Bush too, but he went through with it because he knew that the Kurds were also sitting on top of a lot of oil. And in typical, neoliberal style, they chose for all intents and purposes, they chose a family to run the Kurdish regional government, which is the Barzinis. And so they have been, running the government. That, I mean, it's incredibly wealthy. It's estimated that he probably on a yearly basis makes about $660 million off of oil sales. None of that, or very little of it, filters down to the population. An extremely, exactly the type of corrupt regime that the U.S. loves to work with, because then they don't have to deal with people living in the streets and that type of thing. And there's this, It's not necessarily a military dictatorship. You know, I think the Kurds at this time in Iraq are just really happy to have some level of autonomy from the Iraqi government. And they also recognize that with their army, the Peshmerga, that they really are the only thing standing between Daesh in Mosul and Baghdad. And so that makes them, that gives them a piece of power that they've really never had before, because the Iraqi army is a joke. And then finally, there's a group in Iran, and they're a little bit more displaced in terms of being scattered through the country, and they're more emancipated at the level of rights and things like that within the Iranian state. Not very arrested population, but they're also pretty well integrated. So I met a number of Iranian Kurds. Most of them had college degrees or advanced degrees and were in Rojava doing work for the Kurdish autonomous region. So very different structures, very different, political and real politic interactions with the state. Just by way of example, and I talked about this previously, but in Syria, the Kurdish population were effectively held in poverty by Assad, who was always very nervous about the fact that, PKK was strong within the northern Syrian region and PYD was strong within the northern Syrian region. And that played out 40 years ago when his father was the effective dictator of Syria in a number of cultural laws, which among them outlawed the use of the Kurdish language, Kurmanji, and banned the use of flags that incorporated gold, red, and green, which is the Kurdish national colors. So, this is one of the pieces where you start getting into that kind of netherworld of going into a different culture, where you realize, geez, if I came from a Latino household and I spoke Spanish, what would it be like if the American government banned the speaking of Spanish? That level of oppression, and not just banned it, not made it illegal, but literally you could be picked up, tortured, and killed for speaking, Kurdish during those 40 years.
And the same circumstance in Turkey too, which is a U.S. ally.
Correct. Oh yeah. Well, and we'll have to talk about Turkey at some point in time. I've got some spleen to vent, but I brought back a scarf from Rojava, and the scarf is the colors, the gold, the red, and the green. And there are examples in recent history of individuals wearing the self same scarf being picked up by the police or the secret police in Syria and tortured and killed for wearing a scarf that includes the colors of the Kurdish national colors or the Kurdish regional colors or whatever. So you think about that in terms of the level of oppression, as well as, there's an economic level here too. In Qamishli, which is a town where there's tiny little bits of Syria that are still alive within Qamishli, the level of the economic difference between the Syrian areas and the Kurdish areas is profound. It's hard to imagine, but literally defined by streets. One streets look very Western, very European, banks, airplane offices, business offices, that type of thing. And then on the other side, it's drab, it's concrete, there's not much happening. It's a real example of how the Assad regime did their best to keep the Kurds down. So when the Assad regime started to crumble, you can imagine how rapidly, how quickly the Kurdish population was capable of rising and kind of establishing themselves as being in control of this area of ground. Pretty impressive. And that said, most of the Kurds that I spoke to are actually were kind of ambivalent about Syria. The feeling was is that it was a real bad experience, but it's pretty much over, and they want to integrate as much as possible the Arab folks who are still living in the Kurdish area into the autonomous region. They want to integrate them into the political structures and the things too. I think the more I think about it, the more I see just really the drive to integrate the different separate populations. I went to a couple of commune councils, and there were a number of Arab men and women who attended as well, and I got a chance to speak to them a little bit. And it's almost, prejudice, that type of thing is real difficult to kind of place into a box. But, you know, when you talk to some of the Arab folks, I mean, they've been living in the same villages that the Kurds have been living in, some of their families, for centuries. And their families have known each other for centuries. And, you know, there's hushed up, you know, well, one time, you know, an Arab woman married a Kurd, and we don't talk about that much, but it happened, you know, that type of thing. So, but there is a, there's a real sense of kind of working together. And it's amazing how, you know, the YPG, you can get magazines for the YPG, which publishes a number of magazines on a monthly basis in Arabic, in Kurdish, and then in Latinized Kurdish. So it's not even an attempt. It's done in terms of incorporating as much as possible some of the Arab populations into the flow, the ebb and flow of the autonomous region. And the same for the Assyrian Christians as well, which is a much smaller population. But again, they have their own language, they have their own culture, you know, reaching back to, you know, being one of the oldest Christian communities, you know, a non-Western Christian community, very similar to the one that sprung up around Istanbul, the Greek Christian community there. So, and they're incorporated as well. I actually was given a flag of this new kind of body that they're trying to put together, Free Democratic Syria. And it has the name Free Democratic Syria in Latinized letters, in Kurdish, in Arabic, and then in Assyrian, in Christian Assyrian. So, it's very impressive when you interact with that level of openness and support. The identity politics, the games we play in the U.S. I asked people about kind of what they thought about that, and there was a shrug of their shoulders, and it says they sound like children, you know. So I thought, well, you know, I certainly could devolve to that.
And it seems like markedly, and so to say with the. As you were pointing to the Kurdish, and as you said in your recent conversation with Rydra for Free Radical Radio, that among the Kurdish population, there's not only Muslims, but there's Yazidis and Christians and different kinds of Muslims too, right? So it's not what the picture you're painting right now is a population of or a region that has these populations in it that have been living there for centuries alongside of other groups, and maybe at least the effort going towards not just imposing this like Kurdish revolution, but trying to expand it so that it has room for everyone to administer among themselves and with each other council wise.
Right. And I think this is one of the things that Ocalan has, I mean, the more I look at this Ocalan character, the more I realize that some of his stuff is crazy, like a fox in terms of his, what he's done is, you know, not only guaranteeing the empowerment of women at the level of the councils and the upper councils, but also guaranteeing the representation and the inclusion of, you know, the different religious populations. And in some areas, the religious populations will actually meet as a council, specifically representing the interest of Christians or the interest of Muslims. The Islam practiced by the Kurds is very different from, I think, the Islam practiced by the Arab populations. The Kurds were much more secular. You will see women with scarves over their heads, but it's not, you know, there's no niqabs or burqas or things like that. And the men all dressed in Western fashion. There's no, you know, there's no culturally Arab or Islamic dress that they'll use. So you're right, there are huge variations within the culture and within the religion as well. And I think that Islam among the Kurdish population functions more as a touchstone for culture than it really does a religion. Just another example, walking around Turkey, probably every four or five blocks you'll come across a mosque, some huge, some small, that type of thing. I think Kamishli, a town of 250,000, has about seven. So that kind of gives a feel for the level of you know, attendance at prayer and things like that. So very, you know, very different. And, but nonetheless, one of the ways that I think power gets split up is the fact that recognizing that each one of these religions has different concerns and different power things happening, including the Yazidis, which are really kind of a very interesting population, smaller, but they found themselves, you know, what was it, 6 months, 9 months, 10 months ago or whatever, trapped on Shinar Mountain. And they were rescued. YPG punched their way through and rescued several thousand of them and brought them back across into Rojava.
All while the U.S. was like hand wringing about, like, we can't do anything. Like, we can bomb some people. I don't know.
Yeah, and this is the I actually talked to some of a guy who was with the Peshmerga, you know, and what the YPG did is they found out about it, and within 24 hours they had already made plans about how they were going to punch through, and the problem that they really had is they really needed larger artillery and trucks. So they talked to the Peshmerga and they said, you guys can come along with us if you want to fight with us, but we really need trucks and heavy artillery, you know, obviously all of it provided by the U.S. military. So the Peshmerga, that was kind of their role in that operation, was to provide kind of some of the logistics and support for what the YPG were doing. And it's one of the differences, you know, there are many differences between the YPG and the YPJ and the military as we understand it. And I'm just scratching the surface now, but everything from the personnel that they have, the way that they interact with individuals. One thing I haven't talked about is I hung out with this one kooky commander, Rashad, in Kobani, in his office, basically. So this is the office of the commander of the Kobani commando, you know, 500-600 fighters he's responsible for. And people would come in, they'd drink tea. I never saw a single salute exchanged once with him. Not once. And, you know, when another commander came in, nobody rose to stand up and to come to attention when he came in. I mean, there was just the complete lack of discipline was beautiful. And as I've described before, he also had just a ripping sense of humor. He was really a pleasant guy to be around. And so, you know, and you compare that with any other military on earth, you know, basically, and it gives you a feel for what a militia should be and is supposed to be. I think Daruti, in one of the comments that right up until I went to Rojava used to drive me crazy, is he talked about the discipline of indiscipline. And now that I've seen the discipline of indiscipline, I am quite impressed with it, because, you know, on one hand, I'm seeing a group of soldiers just basically treat each other as brothers, friends, that type of thing, and working together on a daily basis without any hierarchy or structure. And then I think about them in the field and how truly feared they are by Daesh, you know, and how truly fearless they are. You know, even the U.S. military says, wow, they really don't know much about tactics, but these guys just, they'll walk up hills that we would never even think about climbing, you know, under gunfire. So it's a very different militia. And I was really impressed with it. It's still, still hard to talk about, because, you know, as an anarchist, as I've said, it's, you know, the army's the enemy, you know, the military, the police, they're the bad guys. And to have those tables turned on somebody who's lived that way for, you know, 3 or 4 decades is a pretty jarring psychological experience.
You will admit, though, that, like, in a quote unquote, like, revolutionary period, or when a social revolution is, as you've identified it, is going on in a region or in a place, that it's a very volatile thing. Like, do you think that this is something that you could see outside of or aside from external just bombardment from Russia or the U.S. or a re-empowered Assad regime? Can you see this going in a different direction with those power structures? Or what do you think they're doing to make sure that it doesn't become a Cheka and a, like, you know, a military that's turned in on its population for oppression, for like war communism or something like that?
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that the intelligence and kind of the training of the commanders, as well as some of the people who came across from Turkey, is real key here, because, you know, the structures that I'm looking at and the way that these soldiers are interacting with the structures, you know, again, just didn't happen. These have been around since 2005, and in some cases, 2003. So this is a military that's already, or this is a militia that's already tried out these structures and found them to be quite workable in the context of what is in reality even a harder war to fight, because it's a war of insurrection on enemy territory. I mean, it's kind of a Vietnam kind of experience that's going on in Turkey and has been. And, you know, we don't hear much about it, but, you know, since 1984, there have been 40,000 casualties. It is a shooting war. It is a war of, you know, kind of attrition, kind of an almost Irish Civil War type of thing, kneecapping, tit for tat killings, that type of thing. So it's, you know, it's a real war. And these are the structures that they have been using recently to be able to fight that war. So to bring them across and to be able to utilize them, my point ultimately being is that they have a little bit of traction because they have a little bit of mileage. As to whether, you know, when the war settles down or the war heats up or some of these other players begin trying to meddle with what the YPG is doing, if that's going to have any effect, possibly. You know, it's hard to, it's impossible to predict the future. All we can do is pretty much based on what we've seen in the past. And I would say that thus far, any attempt by the U.S. military advisors, the special forces, to try to change any of the military structures in the YPG have been utter failures. You know, they haven't done it. I was impressed with the most recent, you know, when Barack Obama said, well, we're going to send over 50 advisors and they're going to help the YPG. And the YPG, being who they are, sent back immediately, we don't need anybody on the ground. We need weapons, big weapons. You know, it's like, you know, send over the special forces. We'll teach them how to fight. You know.
Or just keep them out of our way, please, because they'll probably
just
screw something up.
Yeah, just we don't want to have any Americans killed while we're shooting at the enemy. You know, so. And it's time for a story. So, we were hanging out with, this guy Rashad at the YPG, and one of his soldiers came in, Kobani, you know, sits right on the Turkish border. And right when I was there, the only shooting that was going on were the Turks and the Kurds were shooting at each other across the border. The Turks had put in a number of tank emplacements, and then the Kurds had gotten their hands on some mortars. And so at night, at least I heard at one time, the Turks would shell the Kurds and then the Kurds would shell back, kind of a little artillery duel, that type of thing. So the most heavily patrolled place right now in Kobani is the border, the Turkish border. And this young man, like very young looking, like extremely young looking, even, you know, at least that was my impression. He needed a ride to the one of the Turkish border outposts. And this, the commander Rashad said, would you mind taking him? Because I had a car at my service, and I said, yeah, sure. No problem. I had no idea how far it was. It was only maybe 15, 20 kilometers out of Kobani. So we took this young man and we're talking to him, and he was 20 years old and he had been fighting consistently, since, the age of 16. So by any definition of any military anywhere, this guy was a combat vet. He'd served the entire time in Kobani and had fought in the siege and had fought in Sarikanya as well. So he had seen at least, you know, 4 to 6 months of on the ground, battle. And, you know, that said, when, you know, I mean, he was just a really pleasant, wonderful young guy. And I still flash on some of these soldiers, not only how young they were and how much experience that they'd had and how much, you know, death and horrible stuff that they'd had, but how delighted they were to talk about, you know, what was going on there and how open they were to having someone come out to their outpost and to ask them questions. It was pretty amazing. It was pretty amazing. And you know, they all wanted pictures. They wanted to make sure that their pictures were seen in America. So it was great. It was really cool. It was
Hell
really
yeah.
cool.
Yeah.
You're listening to Asheville FM on WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville. This is The Final Straw, a weekly anarchist radio show airing from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time every single Sunday, and I'm William Goodenough. We're hearing an interview between Bursts and Paul Z. Simons regarding the dispatches from Rojava, for which Paul is the author. Here is the second half of the interview.
Did you see much in the way of internationalists, any international brigades, Lions of Rojava, any of the, like, could, because anarchists and socialists and communists and other folks that maybe they just don't like Daesh, you know, Danish biker gangs that are maybe Islamophobic, I don't know, but lots of people from the West and I don't know where else in the world have talked about, or I've heard stories of them going and fighting or helping with infrastructure or whatever in Rojava. Did you see much of that? And are there any stories you want to tell about that you can tell?
I did. My second to last night in Kobane, I had gotten really tired of the hotel had a restaurant which was almost never open. I got really tired of the food, so I walked down the hill with the translator, and we'd found a restaurant where, that had like the roasted chickens, just like Safeway or whatever, you know, roasted chickens. And walked into this place and ordered a chicken, and you know, we were kind of waiting around. And all of a sudden, I feel this tap on my shoulder, and I turn around. It's this huge American-looking guy, and he says, "Are you American?" I'm like, "I am." And I said, "Are you American?" He says, "I am." And he had four other Americans around him. These were big dudes. These were really big guys. And I asked them, you know, "Are you here? Are you guys foreign fighters?" And they said, "Yeah, we're just stationed right out of town." So I asked them where they were from. What I got? I got a New Hampshire. I got a Virginia. I got an Iowa or Ohio, and then I got a Deep South, an Alabama or a Mississippi. Three of the four were former special forces.
Wow.
And had, you know, done their military service, had seen what was going on in Iraq when they were there, and had decided they wanted to come back and to assist with to fight with the Kurds. The one guy who really interested me was the guy from Virginia, who had come over just basically to because he felt like it was one of those black and white battles. And you know, this is kind of a heavier set guy, blondish. All of them are wearing different types of comp because they will not let them wear YPG, YPJ, or YPG uniforms. So they have to pretty much buy their own uniforms. So if they're killed or captured by Daesh, they can always disavow the fact that they have foreign fighters. Which evidently there, you know, there's some international thing about, you know, incorporating foreign nationals in civil wars or whatever, which I have no idea what the final ramification of it is. So they're all in their own uniforms, and so this guy had his own uniform, and I said, "So what are you guys here for?" And they said, "Well, we're, you know, three of the four, we're here to kill Daesh." And it's like, okay, that's cool. And then one guy said, "Well, I came over here, I realized it was a black and white fight. I just had no idea what was going on." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you know, this is a revolution happening. This is kind of democracy the way it's supposed to work in the U.S. And I said, "You mean this is democracy like it doesn't work in the U.S.?" He says, "That's exactly what I mean."
That's the Virginian that said that?
This is the Virginian. So this was a real quick interaction. They were complaining a little bit to me about the internet, and they felt they didn't have ability to do a lot of emailing. The hotel I was at had a real good email system and a real good internet. And I told them, it's like, "Look, you know, if you guys want to come up to the hotel and use the internet and use my computer, I would be more than happy to have you come up." And they said, "Okay, so we'll think about it." That night, the young fighter from Virginia and another fighter that I hadn't met showed up. They were going to do an interview with a German journalist from the magazine Der Spiegel. And they sat with me as they were waiting for this German journalist to show up. The other fighter he was with was real skinny, very young, a kid from Chicago who had been there actually through the siege of Kobani. Kind of a partisan of Bookchin and very much a partisan of democratic confederalism, and you know, not a very pleasant person to speak to. But I did get a chance to speak to this Virginia fighter again a little bit and ask him, you know, "So what do you think about the revolution here?" And he says, you know, he first of all, he said, "I wasn't expecting this at all." And he has been involved in some of the soldiers' democratic forms, some of the soldiers' councils. And I said, "So, you know, ultimately, what do you think?" And he says, "Well, I'd really like to read some of the stuff that you're writing. I'm trying to get my hands on, you know, some of the things that people are talking about when we're in meetings and things like that. But it's not easy here. There's not a lot of written material in Kobani. And obviously, they don't have a strong enough internet to be able to download some of this material." So I said, "Well," I gave him my email address, and I said, "Keep in contact if you possibly can. And, you know, I'd very much like to send you some of the things that I've written." I never heard from him again, or at least I have not as yet. But I think that he's representative of kind of a class of these foreign fighters who come over really thinking, "Well, I'm going to spend some time and I'm going to, you know, partake in this battle, this war between, you know, forces of good and evil, light and darkness, that type of thing." And then in the process, they realize that this battle is also won as much for a revolution as it is for, you know, the destruction of Daesh. And So that was real enlightening to me. And then finally, it was mentioned to me by both of these guys that there is a group of fighters there who almost nobody ever talks to and who nobody acknowledges is there. But these are, and this kind of goes back to almost like matinee, movie matinee type of material. They're all from the French Foreign Legion. They're all ex-French Foreign Legionnaires. And they're described to me by these guys who were kind of scary looking as real scary looking. So there are a number of different types of foreign fighters there. There's obviously almost the mercenary type, although they're not making any money off of this. They're doing it, I think, because they really have a Jones to get back at Dash. And then there are the ideological ones who come over because they see it as a revolution. Want to fight the revolution. And then there's this this Virginia fighter who comes over to fight the bad guys and finds out just exactly what the good guys are about and realizes that he's fighting for something a lot larger than just the destruction of Dash. So it was a real mixed experience, but very powerful. I still see all four of those American fighters, each one wearing a different set of khakis and boots and that type of thing. And I think about what they went through to get there, which is, you know, getting across the border is not an easy, pleasant task, especially if you're going over to fight, because then you really have to be, you know, lie and get your way through the border or whatever. And they'll have to get back probably through Turkey because they will never be able to get back through the KRG. So in spite of the fact that I don't really understand the special forces stuff or even these French Foreign Legion stuff, I still have a lot of respect for these guys because they put themselves on the line against some pretty awful, terrible people. And even though they don't understand what they're doing it for, you know, they inadvertently are doing it for the right reason. So kind of a different view and a different group of people that this revolution has attracted to it.
When you said the guy that was with the Virginian, who you talked to later, who was doing the interview was a Bookchinite and he wasn't very pleasant to talk to, is that just a personal thing or because he was some ideological nerd?
The latter, he was an ideological. I mean, he was very young, and you know, there was a lot of ego happening with him. One of my favorite lines that he gave me was, "Boy, if somebody came over the revolution who didn't like Bookchin, I don't know what we'd do." And I was like, "Well, I don't really." So what are you going to do? You know. So I mean, that level of. Just very, very young, not a lot of experience, and I think just had a real difficult time relating to people. And you know, people are people. I met the same kind of guy in a 7-Eleven in New York, and you know, whatever. So, I think that the experience there will likely change him in ways that he probably won't even recognize for years. So, and when I was there, I kind of moved to a place where I was beyond arguing with people. It seemed so unimportant when, you know, folks are giving their lives for a revolution and folks are doing everything they can to make a revolution happen. It just seemed like I didn't want to partake in wasting my energy on something that didn't seem important, which is another one of the lessons I've learned. And one of the things I think I come back with, I come back a lot less sectarian and a lot less strict in my views of anarchism and a lot more open to kind of understanding where other people are coming from, as well as understanding that, you know, if we're really going to support this fight, we've got to do it pretty much as a united group of anarchists without a lot of hyphens involved and without a lot of the bullshit sectarian overblown dogmatic statements that we've been used to making for the past 10 or 15 years. That may be the best thing that happens. I mean, Rojava may be the best thing that happens to U.S. anarchism this century.
So you released a statement in January of this year through Modern Slavery saying, like, God damn it, post-left anarchist supports the revolution in Rojava. And having done a number of research, and as you said, like eating humble pie and things like this, like this idea of dropping the hyphens. Two questions briefly out of that, like,
sure.
This is something that is changing people's lives on the ground there. We need to come together, but that still leaves room, right, for a critical perspective from any individual that doesn't have to be ideological, but just being like, I think there's some interesting things going on here. I think some of these things are problematic, but look at on the ground, like the gender dynamic being shaken up in this interesting way, the ethnic breakdowns and tribalism that's occurring in other parts of the region that this horror show that the U.S. and Western powers, along with the, you know, with Russia and all these existent dictatorships, it's broken down into feudal wars between warlords of various religious sects and ethnicities, saying we got to either grab a piece of the pie or we got to protect our people, and that means attacking these other people. Like, do you see a room for the like critical individual engaging, but still importantly engaging as an anarchist? And also, what does it mean? Does it mean anything to you about? Could you break down a little more about reframing what attempting to address or look at what's going on there from an anarchist, a Western anarchist point of view? Does it mean like where does non-Western anarchism come into it, I guess?
Right. And in terms of the first question, I think it actually begs and forces us to be a lot more critical, and critical in a way that we really haven't been before. Because I would say that what passes for criticism right now in a lot of anarchist circles is just basically dismissing the ideas that are presented by others. And, you know, it's bolstered by logical fallacy, ad hominem attacks, that type of thing. I don't see a lot of really good critical stuff coming out. I see a lot of good theory, and they're two separate things. But a lot of the critical stuff feels to me, and Rojava is an excellent example of this, stuff that, I mean, we didn't know what was going on over there. So people kind of felt free to denounce it, you know, and on the basis of things that, well, you know, Ocalan was a Marxist-Leninist, you know, from 77 to 2005. It's like, it's absolutely true. Absolutely true. And the guy never dodged that at all. But, you know, he's allowed to change. And we should look at the change as opposed to condemning him for the fact that, you know, he had hooked into Marxism-Leninism, thinking that that would be one of the ways that he would be able to realize some level of autonomy for the Kurds. So, I don't think it's losing our criticism at all. I think, you know, we're now called upon to be able to examine stuff on a informed basis, and to be able to say, wow, that makes sense, or wow, that doesn't make sense, or, you know, I mean, but to be able to engage at that level, there's a certain, I think, level, there's a certain level of buy-in or acceptance of the fact that this is in fact an anarchist or a libertarian revolution. Let's look at it through libertarian eyes and see just exactly where it's going and try to understand it from that level, as opposed to dismissing it out of hand because we don't understand the culture, the background of the culture that it's in, the area of the world is relatively foreign to most of us. It certainly is to me. It still is to me, having just spent, you know, 2 or 3 weeks there. It's like, I still don't get it. But nonetheless, you know, from what I've seen and what I can report back to people, this is what it looks like. And again, I would much rather be a tabula rasa than anything else. I would much rather just reproduce as much as possible what I've seen and what my impressions and what my conclusions are, and then ask other people to make their conclusions. I don't really see myself as a polemicist in this instance, more as an engaged journalist. And I, you know, I've said this before, and I'm probably going to say it again a lot. Like, you know, the line from Valkyrie, it's like the von Stauffenberg says, it's like, I've made my decision. I'm here to help others make theirs, and what their decisions are, to support, to not support, not to make a decision, that's absolutely fine. But if you're, you know, to be able to make that decision based on what we know. And the biggest example that I have, and it's actually a huge example, is we knew nothing. There was literally no concept or comments whatsoever about Tevdem. And Tevdem, in terms of implementing democratic confederalism, in terms of leading the revolution, in terms of being one of the most fundamental institutions of these innovations, is key. You know, it would literally be like talking about the Spanish Civil War in Barcelona or in Asturias without mentioning at all the CNTFI. That's the level of ignorance that we were dealing with, I think, prior to me being able to report back what I've seen on the ground. So that means that a lot of that critique and a lot of that dismissiveness really is based in things that were not real. you know, and now we get a chance to, at least for this period in time, because things are changing rapidly and the military situation is changing rapidly according to the mainstream media. So, and there may be responses at the level of revolutionary innovations around that. But right now we can make some level of we can have some level of informed discussion about it based on some of the material that I brought back, as well as, you know, some of the notes and some of the reporting that I've done. So, and that's what I'm encouraging people to do. You know, I don't necessarily want everybody to become a Rojava cheerleader, but then on the other hand, I would like people to take it seriously and to seriously consider what this potentially means, not only on the ground, you know, I said on the ground. Okay.
So that's number two.
That's like two. Okay. I got two more. What's happening over there, but also what's happening here, because I think that I would like to see, and I think it's possible that there will be a resonance there that will affect anarchism here, hopefully in extremely positive ways. And if we do it right, if we're smart about it, can really affect anarchism in positive ways at a practical political level. And just to complete that thought, one of the most practical political levels that we can talk about is anything that the anarchist movement can do to embarrass, alienate the Turkish state at this point in time, and, you know, label them and their president for what he is, a war criminal. I think that anything that we can do around that is going to, you know, not only bring us together, but also can't hurt what's going on in Rojava, because right now the Turkish state is clearly they have done far more damage to Rojava than any ISIS fighter or group of ISIS fighters has ever done. And that's, you know, those types of battles, that type of anger and use of demonstrations and things like that, that's second nature to us. Now we have a target.
So there's been, I've heard rumors that Erdogan,
yeah,
has, you know, allowed Daesh into its own borders, has armed and abetted Daesh within Rojava for the purpose of attacking and undermining Tevdem in that region, and also attacking like the left and anarchists and Kurdish populations in Turkey within its own borders. Can you talk about what you heard about that when you were over there?
Oh, it's verified. I mean, again, we don't see a lot of it here because, of course, Turkey is one of our allies. It has the second largest army in NATO, that type of thing. But, I mean, these are things that in the European media, and if people are interested, The Guardian actually has done a real good job over this. As one ugly little example, June 25th of this year, three cars were smuggled across the border right through the Turkish border crossing there. They were car bombs. They were exploded. And then 100 Daesh fighters disguised as Asayish, who are the internal security in Rojava, snuck across the border and began systematically killing civilians. These individuals came from Turkish refugee camps, and at least previous fighters who've been captured have also discussed this with media as well as military interrogation, where they were recruited and trained in Turkish refugee camps, all under the eyes of the Turkish state.
And those 100 soldiers killed like 230 civilians, right?
230 civilians. And yeah. And, you know, not mom and dad, but the whole family, you know, I mean, talking babies. One of my dispatches is about walking that cemetery. What do you say about an enemy that's willing to walk into a family's home and slaughter them like cattle? You know, that it's not even human. So, and these are the guys that Turkey's working with. These are the guys that Turkey's supporting. So, like I say, it's known, you know, I mean, U.S. military knows that, they've known for years that there's been some support for Daesh as well as al-Nusra through Turkey. And, you know, we rarely hear about it here. And it's certainly never tied to our foreign policy, which is, if anything, it's pro-Turkey. And the Turks, in terms of the European community, you know, they're on the fast track to become a EU state. So, now is a really good time to embarrass the living hell out of the Turks and not the Turkish people, but the Turkish state. I mean, if you want to find an identifiable bad guy in all this, we got one. You know, it's like makes it a little easier for us. I don't need to do some thinking. Just need to, you know, pick up some signs and do something about it. So
dispatches from Rojava, you mentioned the Guardian being good for coverage between, like, connections between the Erdogan and Daesh, or / ISIS, as right. They're called. But are there any other resources that listeners should check out that would maybe help set some context? Maybe like a small key can open a large door, which is available from AK Press, for instance.
I'd encourage people to read some of Ocalan's stuff. Work on democratic and federalism is very interesting and probably worth a read. It's real short. It's kind of like almost pamphlet size. If they're looking for a website that is a little bit more theoretical, a little bit more analytical, I would recommend the Kurdish Question. It's either .org, KurdishQuestion.org, which goes into some of the innovative structures that are currently happening in Kobani. And it's usually in Rojava, and it's usually pretty up to date. And some of it comes out from academics. Some of it comes out from folks who are in Kobani, and some of it comes out from Kurds living around the world. So that's a real good site to kind of take a look at some of the analysis of it. The one thing I don't have is the day-to-day, moment-to-moment type of material. Vice News actually smuggles in reporters pretty regularly, and they'll file video reports. And regardless of how you feel about Vice, these are usually pretty good video reports. They do some real good coverage there. So that's kind of a video option for people to be able to see. They did one that I was really impressed with about a YPJ fighter and her first 45 days of training, which, it's kind of a human interest story, but it's very interesting kind of how the YPJ interact with each other, how they interact with the YPG in that, as well as kind of the women learning how to shoot the weapon and that type of thing. So I always look for Vice. They produce some pretty good stuff out of Rojava. So that's kind of an opening salvo. I'm still looking, you know, after a year of sniffing around and trying to find decent, consistent coverage about it. I was told in Rojava, you should see the YPG website. So I get on the YPG website. It's all in Latinized Kurmanji, which helps me not one bit. I can look at the pictures, but so, and their media apparatus, they actually have Kobani has a TV station called Rojava TV, and it's available by satellite. Most of the time it's a dead station. They're pretty much just playing a slide and then having kind of a crawl underneath it in terms of news from Rojava. But I believe at 5 o'clock Rojava time, they do 2 or 3 hours worth of programming, which is talk shows and a coverage of certain things that are happening in the area. So if people have satellite television, I'm sure that would be interesting. I don't know if any of those episodes are being posted on the internet. And they're starting to subtitle in English, but at least you can get some of the visuals. And I mean, you know, the news, it's like a lot of times, what do I need the voiceover for? I understand what's happening, right? So those are some options, some sources. The KRG runs its own news service. I think it's called Kurdistan State News. And it's another satellite station, and it's in English, so people can get it there. And then finally, the Ukrainians have just put up an English language TV site, which is getting real popular in the Middle East because it's really dedicated to democratic forms, especially after their collision with Putin. And they'll run usually on a daily basis one or two stories about Rojava, which are very interesting. It seems like they have a bureau or people living in Khmeshli who are going out and doing daily stories and then filing them through Kiev to Ukrainian TV. So oddly, that's a really good station too. So there's some options for folks. I would also say what not to look at is, you know, any news item that covers the war in Rojava is pretty much inaccurate, wrong. And you're probably looking at something that's being planted by some of the advisors there about how important the American effort is, you know. So things not to look at, part two. You know, U.S. propaganda porn. So
check. Yeah. Well, Paul, I look forward to continuing this conversation. And yeah, thanks so much for what you're doing and what you've done, what you continue to do. And I look forward to speaking to you soon.
Definitely, definitely. Thank you very much for the time. And yeah, we'll get into maybe a little bit more of the on the ground, number three stuff next time.
You get four of those for the next episode too.
Oh, okay. So each episode is four. Cool.
Yeah.
Well, does the one carry over? Do I have like five?
No, I'm sorry. It's FCC rules. You know, I'm an anarchist and all, but I still have to fall within the requirements of the federal government.
Damn. Okay, all right. Have a great one, man.
All right. You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. You're listening to WSFMLP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw. I'm Bursa Goodness. This show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee, located at 610 Haywood Road. Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. Firestorm's full catalog of books and zines can be found online at firestorm.coop. We've been speaking with Paul Z. Simons, the author of The Dispatches from Rojava, about the situation in Rojava and Kobane. If you're in a hurry to hear the complete conversation on his observations of institutions and organizing on the ground, visit radioforall.net, search for The Final Straw and Rojava, and you'll find all three conversations as separate files, podcasting from that site. Next up, stay tuned for Jeff and Lockie at 3 p.m. with Wordplay, a show on literature, poetry, and other pretty and dark things.